I will tell you about Dr. Rick Hansen, who is my guest. He will be on the microphone shortly here in the studio, and he is a neuropsychologist, which is very heady. So he has a PhD in that, which means he had to take a lot of math and science. So his book, Buddha's Brain, The Practical Neuroscience of Happiness, Love, and Wisdom, has been published in at least 21 languages. Dr. Hansen is the founder of the Wellspring Institute for Neuroscience and Contemplative Wisdom, an affiliate of the Greater Good Science Center, the University of California. He's taught at Oxford, Stanford, Harvard, and in meditation centers in Europe, North America, and Australia. He's an authority on self-directed neuroplasticity. I'm going to have to find out what that's about, because that's a new one for me. So, and he has a new book out. It's called Just One Thing. It was released in October. I actually have a galley copy, a review copy, before it was released. And it gives you a step-by-step guide to turning your emotions around. That's what it's about. It's about how to recover immediately when you have challenges. And I'm going to be talking to Dr. Hansen for a little while, and we're going to open up the phone line so that you, if you have any questions or comments, of course, you can chat with him. It's really a great honor to have him actually here, because he, you know, as I said, he's quite busy, and I tried to book him earlier this year, but he was in other parts of the world, and now we have him here. Now, all that being said, before I go to Dr. Hansen, I just want to tell you I'm back, and I am in the studio now with Dr. Rick Hansen, who is author of Just One Thing. That's his latest book, Developing a Buddha Brain, One Simple Practice at a Time. Hi, Rick. How are you?
Great, Veronica. Pleased to be here.
Oh, thank you so much for taking time out from your humongous schedule, because I
not
mentioned...
Not so humongous.
Well, I've been trying to get you for a couple months now, and I understand you were out of the country, so
yeah.
You're here now, and so I'm really thrilled. So tell me, first of all, about this Buddha brain thing. How did you come up with that, and what's it about?
Yeah. Well, the basic idea is that life is hard on the one side, right?
Mm-hmm.
On the other hand, there have been people throughout history and in the world today who've developed themselves in various ways, which means basically developing their brain. Because, mm-hmm. you know, to use that fancy word, neuroplasticity, the brain's constantly changing for better or worse.
Of course.
You know, the only real question is, who's changing it, them or us, you
mm-hmm.
know?
Mm-hmm.
So what my book's about is how to change it yourself from the inside out, based in science, doing simple practices with your mind that gradually turn on, they stimulate, they light up the neural networks that support really good states of mind, strength of heart, loving kindness for other people, and so forth. And by stimulating them, make them stronger and stronger and stronger, kind of like building a muscle, actually. That's the whole idea of neuroplasticity, that the brain's changing, and you can actually change it yourself for the better.
So you don't need to have some kind of electronic stimulus. So how did you...
That would be pretty scary.
Well, okay. It would be, huh? But, I mean, often, you know, they do this kind of stuff in labs all the time. They
yeah.
hook people up to electrodes and zap
yeah.
them and then check to see, you know, how the waves are looking. How did you discover this? I mean, well, you said this is something that's been going on for a while, this research.
Mm-hmm.
But how do we know for a fact that it has actually physically changed?
Yeah, good question. So first off, I thought of like three quick examples I could give you. So
okay.
one is taxi drivers in London. They've got to memorize the spaghetti snarl of streets there. At the end of their training, a part of the brain called the hippocampus, which you don't have to remember, but
mm-hmm.
the hippocampus, which does visual spatial memory. So they worked that muscle. Well, at the end of their training, that part of the brain is measurably thicker on MRI scans and things like that.
Mm-hmm.
In other words, they built up synapses, they built up blood flow, and because they built it up, it's now stronger, it can do more for them. A second example is people who routinely do some kind of mindfulness meditation. They build up neural tissues in two key parts of the brain. One is called the insula, which is involved in self-awareness as well as for tuning into other people. And another part of the brain that gets built up by people who meditate, and meditate broadly, I would include prayer, any kind of contemplative practice. Doesn't need to be Buddhist, you know, which is my background, but could be any kind probably. Anyway, they also built up a part of the brain toward the front, just behind the forehead, that's involved in controlling attention. And it kind of makes sense. You know, if you do something over time, you'll build up that muscle. So they, meditators, we, whoever, you know, does it, is tuning into themselves, and they're also controlling their attention. So they're building up the neural substrates, the neural layers that do that thing. That would be a second example. So those are two examples, you know, on the better side of the ledger, if you will. But on the worse side, people who are routinely stressed, living a hard life or being upset a lot or just feeling threatened, etc., let alone people who've been through serious trauma, they experience a lot of cortisol releases. That's a stress hormone, which gradually eats away at the hippocampus, which I've been talking about. It actually kills up to about 25% of the neurons in the hippocampus at the upper limit, and with acute, you know, and intense stress over a long time. Anyway, if that happens, the hippocampus doesn't just have a harder time making visual spatial memories. It has a harder time creating context, because that's what it does for our daily experience. It helps us put things in the big picture, and the hippocampus also puts the brakes on the alarm bell of the brain, which is the amygdala. People have heard about.
Oh, yes.
And so then you have a vicious cycle, right? Cortisol today both sensitizes the alarm bell amygdala, and it weakens the brakes and the big picture creator of the hippocampus. That happens today, which makes us a little more vulnerable to stress tomorrow, which makes us really vulnerable to stress the day after tomorrow. To my point, the brain is continually changing. The idea for me that's so important is that while I think it's incredibly important to make the world out there, you know, a better place, work on the environment, I'm not seeing that environment changing too quickly, right?
Yeah.
You know, I went
to
college in the late 60s, early 70s. I'm in my 60th year now, been around the block, and, you know, hey, some things have gotten better, some things haven't, some things have gotten worse. Meanwhile, what can we do inside our own heads? You know, that's my own particular little corner of the puzzle, if you will. It's my piece of the puzzle. What can we do with our minds alone to change our brains for the better that's, you know, grounded in science? And there's a lot of opportunity now that's increasingly clear, and I try to write about it in my book. It's a bunch of little practices, simple things people can do in daily life. You know, I'm a guy in the trenches, got young adult kids. I've been a therapist a long time. You know, I want to help people in the real deal, their real life, right in the middle of the mess, you know. And that's kind of what that book's about, Just One Thing.
Well, you know, I think it's really important. As a matter of fact, it's become something that's, you know, totally associated with survival at this point in our society, the way things are going now, and not only the situations that we're having to deal with right now, but also, you know, some dire situations have been predicted for the upcoming future for us. So certainly people need to personally feel more empowered, and they need to, well, have the discipline to do this. So let's talk about that, you know. I mean, how do you, most people try to avoid things like meditation on a regular basis and going to the gym, things like that. So how do you address that in your book?
Well, you must have read my mind, because yet again today I failed to exercise.
Oh,
so
no.
There you are. But anyway, well, you're exactly right. You know, if how can I put it? The most important thing to do is the one you're going to do, right? And so in the book, you know, it's got 52 little practices that are all easy to do. But more broadly, I think it's important to kind of start, number one, by getting on your own side. It's really interesting how many people are good to others, but they're hard on themselves.
I just talked about that, yeah.
Yeah, they're not for themselves. That doesn't mean being against others, but it means, you know, extending kindness and good wishes and strength of heart to the one person in the world you have the most power over. You know, moral duty is in proportion to power. We have more responsibility based on power, right?
Right.
Who's the person we have the most power over? It's ourself, especially our future self. So that's one part of it. And it kind of weighs into that, that are, you know, informed by the recent neuroscience. One key way in is through self-compassion. And a key way to get to a place of having a basic quality of wishing that you not suffer. That's the essence of compassion. Interestingly, is to prime the pump by starting with a few seconds or half a minute or so with a felt sense of feeling cared about by something, by your pet, by your friend, by your sweet grandmother, by a stranger on the street who smiles at you, by the guys in the, I'm thinking of the guys in the deli who make my salad, whatever, you know, my chicken salad, you know, they like me. Okay, we, whatever, we, they don't love me, but they like me. All right, I feel cared about, whatever. You know, that right there is a great way to prime the pump. Just a half a minute of feeling cared about, then you can be feel more caring, including toward yourself.
Yeah.
That would be an example. And studies have shown that if you do start by caring, feeling cared about, it kind of lights up the attachment circuits of the brain, the relationship, the love circuits that help you be more caring, including toward yourself. I'll tell you one more little example that's big for me.
Oh, I'd love to hear it, yeah.
Yeah, well, part of the background here is to appreciate the ways that this brain evolved. You know, brain, nervous system's been evolving 600 million years, right? And that's a long time. And Mother Nature, she doesn't care about happy. She cares about survival. You know, rule one in the wild is eat lunch today, don't be lunch today, right?
Right.
You know, so we're primed to go negative. We're primed because we got to get away from those sticks, and we're primed to be afraid. We're primed to get angry. We're primed to be frustrated and disappointed. And the way the brain works is that it immediately registers any negative experience. Once burned, twice shy.
Right.
But positive experiences, unless they're million-dollar moments, go right through the brain like water through a sieve because they have, you know, standard issue memory systems, which require a person to pay attention to something 10, 20 seconds in a row for it to transfer to, from short-term buffers to long-term storage, right? Well, we don't usually do that. We might be having lots of little positive experiences. A lot of people do, but the brain doesn't register them. But it registers every negative one. It's like Velcro for negative experiences, but Teflon for positive ones. That's how it's designed to keep our ancestors alive. It's a great plan for keeping, you know, lizards alive, rats alive, monkeys alive, early, you know, cavemen, cavewomen alive, what have you. But it's lousy for quality of life, and it's lousy for long-term health, because when you get stressed by the negativity bias, it's bad on your body. So one practice in the book, and one of my favorites, is I call take in the good. In other words, when you're going through the day and there are these little facts that are good, they're not super duper and it's not rose-colored glasses, you're seeing the bad facts as well.
Yeah.
But the brain's biased toward the bad facts. You know what I mean?
Yes.
Yeah. So it's about really, when you see that good fact, I go through it in detail. I'll spare you all that stuff right now. But, you know, let yourself really feel it. Stay with it 10, 20, 30 seconds in a row. It's a little private moment. Nobody needs to know you're feeling good inside. Let the needle move and feel like it's sinking in. And bit by bit, because as they say in brain science, neurons that fire together wire together. So you get those neurons firing together on that positive experience. It'll slowly but surely, whether it's a London taxi driver or someone walking down the street, just taking a moment to feel grateful for simply being alive, or for, you know, the fact that coffee tastes good or ain't dead yet, you know, kids are laughing, what have you. That little moment is changing your brain if you do it deliberately.
Well, I mean, it's certainly something that we're missing in this society. But, you know, as you were talking about how the brain is wired and mostly to protect you, in other words, which comes across as, we would assess it as a negative kind of thing, reaction. How did it get that way? I mean, I don't think it started out being that way, because it seems to me we wouldn't have survived.
Well, if I follow you right, think about it. So in the wild, you got to get carrots and you have to avoid sticks, right?
Right, okay.
So if you fail to get a carrot today, you'll probably have a chance at a carrot tomorrow.
Right.
But if you fail to avoid a stick today as a little primate 30 million years ago, you know, or a mammal 200 million years ago, if you fail to avoid a predator, or you fail to avoid lethal aggression inside your baboon troop, or lethal aggression between early hunter-gatherer humans, right?
Right, right.
If you fail to avoid it, whap, no more carrots forever. So the brain gradually accumulated a kind of a bias. There are some interesting and fairly minor exceptions to that. For example, people usually will edit out the pain in their personal history to some extent. You know, I've done a lot of rock climbing, and I'll usually forget, you know, how much my feet hurt. All I remember is the cool experience at the end of the day, you know, the beer I had with my buddy, whatever, when we got down alive, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But generally speaking, no. There are many examples. For example, think about you're in a relationship. 10 things happen with that person that day. 5 are mildly positive, 4 are neutral, 1's mildly negative. Which one do you think about before you go
to
sleep?
The negative one.
Yeah.
Because you're thinking you better, you know, it's a red flag.
Mm-hmm.
You better be alert for some more negative stuff.
Yeah.
It could mean something.
Yeah, exactly. Another example, it's really easy to make mammals, including us, feel helpless. It's easy to train people in a sense of futility and despair that they can't do anything, so they just kind of give up. And this has a lot of political implications.
It sure
does.
You
know, not just personal. But it takes it takes much more effort to help people to unlearn a sense of helplessness and to appreciate that they really can be a hammer instead of a nail in their life. That would be another example of the negativity bias.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, what you mentioned about helping yourself feel good is what people do, you know, when they have religious experiences, you know, and I don't mean a specific religious experience, but that's what they want to get out of getting involved in religion is this connection to God or whatever they believe in that brought them here, that loves them more than they love themselves. And so, I mean, I think this book is really important because it brings you back to the idea, first of all, that you can do this yourself. I know a lot of people have very negative associations with organized religion. But what you're suggesting, though, is that you can basically do that and very well, because there you don't have to go over this cavernous belief thing. In other words, you can practice this without believing in God, taking yourself through that emotional thing, or a higher power even. You can just enjoy the day, you know, enjoy the fresh strawberries that you got that were incredibly good compared to what you had. You know, I mean, just the little things.
Yeah. I guess I like tools, you know, and I don't like feeling helpless, and I like offering tools to people. I still think back on the Whole Earth Catalog, you know, one of the genius books of all time.
Oh, yeah.
You know, tools. It's about knowing how to do stuff. And so in that, what I tried to do is to just basically mine, just kind of grab the low-hanging fruit of what's currently known in brain science, you know, about how we can have more powerful tools ourselves to take charge of our caveman brain, cavewoman brain, you know, work with this inner iguana, you know, the inner lizard, whatever, you know, the inner rat, the inner monkey we have, and everybody has in their brain. There's just one brain. There's a human brain, you know, deep down, and what are we going to do about it? So for me, that's what I wanted to do, and if people want to use that, the way I think of it is there are 3 great purposes for that sort of thing. One is to heal from past experiences that are injurious and harmful and even traumatizing.
Yeah.
Second purpose people can use those tools for is personal growth, you know, which includes building up resources inside to make this world a better place.
Mm-hmm.
It's hard to sustain the good fight, you know, if you're running on empty inside. And then the last is if they're interested, because I do have a background in meditation. If they are interested, you know, they can use these methods to deepen their own spiritual practice, you know, whatever that is. But that's not, I wouldn't describe that as the primary purpose of the book. You know, for me, more than anything else, it's to develop what I call a Buddha brain, which is a brain that knows how to be deeply happy, deeply strong, and resilient no matter what happens to it.
Mm-hmm. Well, we certainly need this in this day and age. And you mentioned how challenging it is, and I always point to news reports. I mean, how much negativity there is, and how you know, there's nothing ever positive. And as an African American, my own personal experience is there are always negative statistics about how, well, you know, if the unemployment report comes out and it's bad, well, it's worse for African Americans, you know. And I just get so tired of that, to tell you the truth, Rick. And your book suggests some things, but, you know, it'd be really great if people took this on as a group, you know, to support each other, because there's so much of it, you know, and we need to constantly, you said how many times it takes before you stimuli response before you get it.
Yeah, but the good news is 10, 20 seconds. You know,
but then you have to keep repeating that for yourself.
If people do, just actually take those extra 15, 20, 30 seconds to just stay with a good experience, as just one of the 52 practices in the book.
Yeah.
That definitely will gradually change their brain over time, and they certainly report that. And I agree with you about, the saying in journalism, if it bleeds, it leads, right? You know? Because that's what we pay attention to.
Uh-huh.
We pay attention to anger and loss and fear and danger. I think that, the truth is that there's so many things around the world and in our lives and in our own hearts that are really actually good.
Mm.
And
you think so?
Yeah,
no,
I do.
Okay. So I just interviewed Ilanka last week. She has the newspaper called Positive News, and she thinks there are a lot of positive things. And I'm inclined to believe that also. And I think even our programming tells us there aren't very many positive things. I'm not arguing with my guests here. I'm just saying that, but it's the little things that you mentioned that we ignore every day.
Oh, yeah.
You know, like the fact that, when you did you drive here? You drove here. You didn't have an accident.
Right.
That's outstanding.
Oh, I know.
There were so many.
we don't notice all the bad things that could have happened but didn't, right?
There were so many opportunities. How many miles did you drive?
About 25
or
30.
See that, and you went
in my Prius.
Bridges.
I was ecologically good.
There you go. Right. There could have been an earthquake. The bridge could have collapsed, and all kinds of things.
People often think that it's either or. You know, that somehow you're either seeing the world in a negative way or a positive way.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes people who are very focused on social justice get irritated at people who say, well, okay, but there's still also some good things too, as if you're being disloyal to the cause, you know?
Yes.
And my point of view is I want to just see what the truth is and see the whole picture, the whole picture, which includes lots of oppression, lots of horribleness, lots of tragedy. I see in my mind's eye right now a photograph of a member of the Untouchable cast in India. I saw in a news story recently mucking out a sewer, literally sewage. She's knee deep in sewage in a bathing suit. He's mucking it out with a crowbar.
Yeah.
You know, at the end of his day's work, he goes home to his wife and his two kids smelling of what.
Mm.
And, it's really hard on the one hand. On the other hand, I think that there are so many clearly good things within people, ordinary virtues, determination, just being able to survive their life, their childhood, what have you, decency, fair play, kindness for other people. There's so many good things, And I do happen to think that classically throughout history, one of the strategies that you see again and again and again is ruling elites work to make people doubt themselves.
You're not kidding.
And to not see the good in themselves or not see the good in others.
That way they can control them.
Exactly. Yeah. You lose heart then. You're a lot easier to be satisfied with bread and circuses, the modern media life we have today. And, it kind of breeds a sense of futility. There's a diminution or there's a lessening of the sense of the possible good. And so people just, they don't pursue the possible good because they don't even
settling.
Imagine.
It's true. Just what you, by the way, if you're just tuning in, this is The Week Starts Here. I'm Veronica Faison, having a wonderful conversation right now with Dr. Rick Hansen. He's the author of Just One Thing. It's his latest book. The other book was called
Buddha's Brain, The Practical Neuroscience of Happiness, Love, and Wisdom.
All right. And if you have any questions or comments for Rick, by all means, feel free to call us. The telephone number is 510-848-4425. Or 1-800-958-9008 if you'd like to participate in this conversation. Rick, we have Dino already. Hey, Dino. Dino. LaFleur, where's Dino? Dino, LaFleur, you have to lock him in first. Oh, there he is. I heard him. Dino, how are you?
I'm doing terrific because this ties in. I had called earlier about my goal. for the resolution.
Oh, I missed that. Okay.
And this actually ties into it. My question, I'll present my question, but I wanted to share a couple tools that I use to help me just look at things more positive. And one is this thing, I don't know if you've heard of it, called the Platinum Rule. So it's a take on the Golden Rule, but it's phrased a little differently, and it says, do not do unto yourself what you would never do to someone else.
Wonderful. I'm loving it.
Wow, I like that.
Where'd you discover that, Dino?
This film called Finding Joe about Joseph Campbell.
I love that film. I have a copy of it.
Oh, I want to get a copy of it. And,
okay.
One of the guys, I guess, who was quoted in the film, he has a website, and I found it from there.
Mm-hmm.
I don't remember the name of it right offhand. Philosopher's Notebook. Anyway. And then the other thing is I stopped asking people, how are you doing?
Okay, what do you say now?
I say, what's the good news?
Oh, wonderful. That's great.
And, man, that's really, really helped me out. But my question is, and this ties in with my goal. My goal is not so much, a tangible thing, but it's more like a practice. And the thing that I want to accomplish is to, attend to things kind of like every day instead of, like, putting stuff off.
Procrastinating.
Well, not procrastinating, but, like, not saving things for one big, crush of work, but kind of just to pursue things, day by day.
How come that's not procrastinating, Dino?
I'm not sure. I guess procrastinating is kind of putting stuff off, but I guess what I want to do is just go and develop something so that I practice stuff, like I practice my musical instruments, that I practice my homework and everything else consistently instead of, going at it sometimes never and sometimes just crazy.
So, Dino, do you have a question or comment for Rick?
Yeah, that is the, like, how is it possible to, I guess maybe I have an idea, like I like this idea, and how do you overcome resistance to what you know you want to do?
Okay, yeah. Let's let him take your answer on the air. Thanks for calling, Dino.
All right, thanks.
Okay.
Well, hey, Dino, first off, I mean, I don't know you, of course, but I just love what you said about the Platinum Rule and everything else. And the way I understand your question, it's the million-dollar question. How do we motivate ourselves to do the things that are good for us that we don't want to do?
Mm-hmm.
In other words,
right.
It's easy to do the stuff that you want to do for yourself. How do we keep doing the things that are good for us but we don't want to do? And, I certainly grapple with that as well. That is where I do think about the power of taking in the good, in particular, taking in, the felt sense of the reward that would come to us from doing the thing we want to do. In your case, as I hear it, a kind of continuity, a sort of equanimous, even-keeled stability day in and day out where, you're turning the wheel day in and day out without lots of extremes of either putting it off, and then kind of bursting with activity. Kind of like binging and purging.
Right.
You don't want to do that. You want to be even and steady. You're running the marathon at a certain pace. You can't run it like a 40-yard dash, right?
Right.
So for example, what a person might do then is to both anticipate the rewards. And by rewards, I mean good feelings of any kind, including the good feelings that various ripples of benefit will spread out from you to help other people. So it's rewarding to feel that you're helping other people when you maintain consistency in your practices day in and day out, when there's a steadiness of contribution, coming off of you day in and day out. So that's a reward, for example.
You're a calmer person, easier to be around, I imagine.
That's a way to motivate yourself, including whether you want to motivate yourself to be more passionate, let's say, or
right.
Artistic or loving or whatever. The other thing, just to wrap up on this one, is I look for those little things that are like, they're the catalyst. And for me, honestly, it's when I get to bed the night before. If I get to bed at a reasonable hour rather than, stay up that extra hour to watch SportsCenter or whatever, then I can get up earlier in the morning. I can start my day well.
Mm-hmm.
I do some practices in the morning that gets me going, and then I'm set to go. So it's really interesting. Very often for people, there's a little thing that has a big result in terms of setting themselves up to win. And you might want to think about what is that one thing,
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Thanks, Dino.
Yeah, thanks, Dino. And before... We're going to be with Life for a minute, but first I just want to say that I remember having a conversation that got very heated. It almost turned into an argument with someone about whether or not you could be happy without money. Because she was very adamant, if you don't have money, you can't get health, good health care, you can't, you know, your kids can't get good education and all that stuff. And there are really people, we are entrenched with that in this society. Mm. And I am just so concerned, and I think your book is getting back to the individual will have a positive overall effect on the community and you know, the types of things that people allow themselves to believe, because obviously, you know, the banking industry, they want us to think we can't be happy without money, mm-hmm. you know, because they can't be happy without our money. But the bottom line is that, you know, I want people to just get back to just enjoying life every day, and just to know that if somebody's living off a dollar a day somewhere in the world, it doesn't necessarily mean automatically that they're suffering and they're in abject misery because we think we couldn't live off a dollar a day. So I think it really helps put things in perspective.
Yeah, I'd say two things to that really quickly. Mm-hmm. First is that, going to the point I made earlier about it's not either or. You know,
right.
Sometimes it's often set up that you're either gazing at your navel, trying to make yourself feel good,
right.
or you're in the street, you know, up against the wall, you know, revolution and so forth. And the truth is they support each other. You know,
yeah.
acting to make the world a better place feeds us individually. But on the other hand, to sustain our engagement with the world, we need to keep filling ourselves up. After all, otherwise we start running on empty.
Yeah,
you know?
Of course.
And there's a lot of research that shows, as well as just direct practical experience we can see around us, that it's when you do things yourself to help yourself feel stronger, less stressed, less angry, less afraid, help yourself feel more cared for by other people, help yourself feel more like you do have good stuff inside you,
mm-hmm.
you know, realistically that's good inside you, and that you can actually do some things to make this world a better place, even if it's only not being a jerk to the, you know, to the person standing next to you, whatever,
right?
By doing that, then we have more that we can draw upon to engage social action. That would be my first point.
Mm-hmm.
And then the second point is that if you think about it, if we are, you know, to use the metaphor from the Buddha, he talked about the two darts. You know, the first dart is unavoidable. Stuff happens. You know, I won't swear on the air, but
Please don't. Stuff happens.
You know what I mean?
Right.
Right. Whatever it is, you know, ranging from a physical injury to, you know, being the target of institutional oppression to just bad events. You get laid off or, you know, you want to be with somebody and they don't want to be with you, or
mm-hmm.
you catch cold or you're stuck in rush hour traffic. Fill in the blanks.
Mm-hmm.
Something happens. The first start lands.
Mm-hmm.
We cannot escape all the first starts of life. We
mm-hmm.
do what we can to deal with them, right? And
mm-hmm.
we try to, you know, reduce them over time for ourselves and others, but they still will land. The problem is we usually add these second darts
mm-hmm.
to that first dart.
Mm-hmm.
We get mad at ourselves. We blame ourselves. We start going to war with other people around
right.
us. We get our knickers in a twist in various ways. We anesthetize ourselves against the experience of the first dart with drugs and alcohol. We go home and we kick the dog, whatever it is. And, you know, what I write about a lot in the, you know, Just One Thing is ways we can not throw second darts. You know what I mean?
I know exactly
or once,
what you mean.
Yeah, or if we're caught up in a second dart cascade, we can get a grip, slow down, stop it,
mm-hmm.
and be, you know, prevent it the next time.
Learning to operate a control board is an excellent example of that, because if something happens, if one thing goes wrong and you panic, then there'll be the next thing,
mm-hmm.
thing. So it's important to recover as soon as possible. And as I mentioned, if you're just joining in, this is KPFA. The week starts here with Veronica Faison. I'm pleased to be in the room with Rick Hansen, PhD neuropsychologist, and we're talking about basically how to take care of yourself, you can trick your brain. That's what I read somewhere in some of your PR stuff. You probably didn't write that. And I have Leif from Berkeley on the line. Hi, Leif. Leif? LaFleur said you were there, Leif. Was she kidding me or what? Hi, Leif. Everybody remember, we have to lock in Leif before we can put him on the air.
Am I on?
Oh, there you are. Hi, Leif. How are you? Welcome.
Okay, I was talking, but okay, you got it working.
All right.
You're working the board there.
No, I'm not. But...
Oh, well, somebody is. Yeah, I'm having real problems with money and this type of stuff, but I'm actually struggling. I've been falling asleep in my chair for the last 4 nights trying to, not worrying, but just trying to make a game plan, trying to get more organized. But anyway, I was thinking about what the gentleman said. I've been doing this for like a couple years now at least, where like pretty much the two meditations is meditating when I'm about to leave a friend or just left the friend, what would happen if I never saw them again. You just do it in a casual way for a couple seconds, and that makes you appreciate them more. But along with that, I've been doing that where if something I see that's nicer or that I like, and I just kind of dwell on it a little bit, just like he said.
Mm-hmm.
And with those two little meditations, just those thoughts, those two things, like what happened if I never got to eat good food again when I'm eating my food, just think about it for a couple seconds, and maybe I probably do that for about 20 seconds. All these things happen, and the succession of things happening. First of all, you obviously appreciate those things better. And then the next thing that happens is you appreciate more things. It kind of has a cascade effect because those little things, like a little flower that you weren't paying attention to, then when you notice something that's really, really cool, that's even more better. That's even more exciting. And then the other thing that happens is, which really surprised me, is you get these sudden bursts of joy out of nowhere. And I was wondering if your guest could comment if that's some of his experience. Because I've had talked to other people about this, and they experience the same thing. It's where it's going around, and you see something like a butterfly, and it brings you so much happiness that you're just laughing.
All right. Thanks for calling, Leif. Go ahead, Rick. What do you think?
Thanks, Leif. That was great. Well, first off, I totally agree with you that many people, me included, when we, open to what is good, right, amidst mm-hmm. what's not so good, but when we open to what is good and we see it in reality, there's a kind of, I think of it almost as a sort of humility or modesty that we're willing to recognize those good things and to be humble enough to see what's true out there. Yeah, we can really get a big spike, right? A big zap of
just
a good feeling. Additionally, I'd two thoughts about what you were saying, Leif. The first is that you're pointing to, and also Dino did the same thing, you're pointing to the power of doing little practices. And you added some. I don't have what you brought up in my book, and that's cool. I just grabbed 52, and there are a lot more than 52 practices in the world. But you're getting at, Dino, as well, the power of practice, which for me is really important. It's this basic idea that there are things we can do ourselves, mm-hmm. no matter what's happening out there, little things under our control, when so much these days is not under our control, that can make our own lives better, and then as a result gives us more ability to help other people make their lives better. So the power of practice, I'm a fan of that one. And the other thing is, you pointed out, in effect, what I think of as often the biggest value of doing practices, it's not the practice itself. It's the implicit benefit in the practice in getting on your own side and taking action and treating yourself like you matter,
mm-hmm.
particularly if you've had a life in which you haven't felt like you've mattered that much to other people.
Mm-hmm.
But at least you matter to yourself, So it's like, two benefits, two good things for one simple action, when you mm-hmm. do a little practice. And I like that. That's a highly leveraged rate of return there, using some banking lingo here.
And I think it's important because also it builds up your courage for doing, even more dramatic things to support yourself.
Yeah.
But this builds the foundation. I think that's what's really important. And I'm going to say the telephone number again is 510-848-4425 or 1-800-958-9008 if you'd like to participate in this conversation with Rick Hansen. Hi, Jab. How are you?
Hey, I'm doing well. How are you?
I'm doing fine. Thanks for calling.
Tuned in on the car and parked and listening. And, so my deal is I have just started, I've been doing it for a long time, actually, but I just kind of retitled it. I've been working with at-risk youth through music.
And I'm now. I remember now.
I'm now starting to work with seniors and gifted, like, super, and I've worked with gifted kids before, but I mean, like, really, really gifted kids. I did a workshop, 2-day workshop at Kansas City Art Institute this fall, in which 160 children, freshmen, in their foundations program created 11 pieces of music in 7 classroom hours. And they did this with percussion instruments of their own making, wow, using the campus as the environment. And they did this with their voices. And they all had homework, which was to spend 30 minutes in silence and write, draw anything, any medium to get across, mm-hmm, everything that you observe, internally, externally. And I had so many people thank me for giving them that 30 minutes. And I'm like, no, you gave it to yourself, mm-hmm, but I'm glad I facilitated that for you.
All right.
And the messages that I got from these people were, I hear myself breathing, I hear myself swallowing, I realize that my hand moving across the page makes its own sound. My hair is tangled in my earrings, you know, the men stare at my body like they always do, and it makes me, you know, I mean, it's just, one, I feel my skeleton walking. I mean, these amazing things, and I've practiced in and out, haven't been complete, you know, devoted to it, Buddhism for 25 years, I believe. And those moments of stillness are so incredible. I often preface my workshops by showing John Cage's 4 minutes and 33 seconds.
Well, Jab, you've really given us a lot to think about here. It sounds like you're doing some good work, and why don't we go ahead and let Rick respond to you, and thank you so much for calling.
Thank you for having me. It's my honor.
Okay.
Well, first, I feel a kind of gratitude to you, Jab, that you're doing that kind of work. You know, I work with kids, too, and they're near and dear to me, and I just think that's fantastic. I consume music. I don't produce it. So mm-hmm, I always really respect people who can produce music. And just as a detail, you probably are aware of, music is a hot area of research these days in terms of the brain. And you may know Oliver Sacks' book. I bet you do.
Oh, yeah.
Called Musicophilia, his recent book. Musicophilia. He's a great lover of music. Oliver mm-hmm Sacks, who's a neurologist and a fantastic writer about people's experiences. And one thing that's really fantastic about music is that it's really integrative. It integrates both sides of the brain, and, you know, in terms of both the melody and the percussion line, left and right. And, you know, it also is very open-hearted, you know, and it joins us with other people as well. So mm-hmm, it's kind of like the trifecta or something, you know, when we work with people about music.
Musicophilia, huh?
Yeah.
Okay, Rod Oliver. All right, so we have Chris on the line from San Francisco. Hi, Chris.
Hi, Veronica. I just want to thank you so much for your book, Doctor.
Oh, thank you.
Yeah, the Buddhist Brain. I'm a graduate student in psychology.
Yeah.
So I'm actually using it heavily in the development of my dissertation. But I was wondering if you could speak a little bit to, you mentioned recently courage. And what I have found in my practice is that there seems to be a direct correlation between the level of courage that I bring to my work and something that you were just mentioning, Veronica, which is there really is an abundance of resources out there, but the level of courage that you can bring to your practice seems to be entirely commensurate to the synchronicity of accessing your necessary resources.
Huh.
That's very interesting. Well, first off, Way to go. Thank you, Chris. And I tell you one thing I learned. You know what a PhD stands for, right? Piled
right. Higher
and deeper.
Right.
So keep going. You know, it's a test of perseverance, master's level, mm-hmm. you know, and the doctoral level. Keep going. The thing I would say about courage is, you know, it's interesting. The longer I've been doing, I don't know, personal growth work for about 35 plus years. And, you know, the longer I do this, the more I appreciate sort of fundamental homespun kind of down to earth values like courage. And I've been thinking more and more about courage. And I think that courage is based to some extent on a synchronicity, as you put it, between, you know, a person's values and their read of the environment. But think about the kind of courage that's also present when everything's hopeless. I think of the image right now in my mind of some lone guy, a man standing in front of tanks in Tiananmen Square.
Oh, yeah.
Or I think about Nelson Mandela having the courage to just hold strong, you know, in jail for 27 years. Other people like that, and many, many people who, you know, like the person in Tiananmen Square, we don't know their names, but our world has been built with their blood and sweat and bodies, often, you know, putting, you know, themselves on the line. So I think also about the courage it takes in everyday life, you know, not standing in front of a line of tanks necessarily, or, you know, demonstrating in a square, whatever it's called, Tahrir, I think, in mm-hmm. You know, in Egypt, in Cairo, but mm-hmm. The courage it takes to speak your truth directly to another person in the face of non-agreement.
Oh, yeah.
You know, that takes a lot of courage. And the courage it takes to acknowledge your own experience to yourself. Mm-hmm. I find for a lot of people, that's ground zero for them. You know, for them to really feel into how much it hurts inside, or to feel into the damage they're doing to themselves and others by whatever, drinking, running their anger on others, to really acknowledge that, or to have the courage to open to really feeling their longing for love.
Right.
And the desire to stick their neck out and ask for it.
Or telling somebody you love them, not knowing, you know,
yeah,
if they're going to say they're flattered.
Yeah, or not.
Right.
Yeah. So there's a lot of, I think there are many, many kinds of courage. And, you know, in addition to the ones that are based on synchronicities. And a little detail, I, methods guy in the trenches that I am, I think about what fosters courage. And you probably know the root of the word courage is French, cœur, heart.
Right.
Yeah, how do you strengthen the heart? And, you know, I think in Chinese medicine, it's interesting that of the five flavors, sour, sweet, and so forth, bitter is the flavor that feeds the heart. Isn't that interesting?
Yes, I think so.
Yeah, there's some way in which an openness to the truth of that which is bitter in life, to mm-hmm. include that, mm-hmm. can bring heart to us. Additionally, I think it's great to call up in the jukebox or the iPod, you know, not dating myself anymore, to call up experiences when you felt strong in the past, you know, to bring up kind of the feeling in the body, the feeling in the chest, the feeling in the heart, when you, whatever it was, lifted that last bit of weight, you know, walked that baby till she finally fell asleep, mm-hmm. stood up for a friend, finished that that race you ran, you know, in my case, sometimes in the outdoors, you know, just doing what it takes to survive and get down to, you know, see the sunrise. By calling up those felt experiences of strength, mm-hmm. you know, we build up their neural substrates again and again and again. You know, neurons that fire together wire together, so the more we get them firing, including related to feelings of strength, the more we're going to build up the wiring of courage in our heart and mind.
Mm-hmm. And I think courage actually activates synchronicity.
Well
said,
yeah.
Once you step out.
It's a circle, yeah.
Exactly. Then you can see what's happening. That's your, you go get your magic that way.
Maybe that's part of what Chris meant.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. So I think, I believe the courage comes first. And, you know, as you say, it can be a circular thing. Synchronicity, I don't really know if synchronicity brings courage. I don't really know that, you know, so I'm not going to step out and make a commitment to that.
Yeah, but I think the way I heard that is, what, you know, if the environment lines up. I mean, the other thing is to call up the sense of people who have your back.
Yeah.
You know, we're, again, negativity bias. We have a really loud critic committee inside mm-hmm. our head mm-hmm. that's yelling at us and telling us we can't do it, don't try, et cetera.
Right.
What about the cheerleader committee, you know what I mean? The support committee, the nurturing parent committee or the nurturing friend committee. And most of us have a very kind of weak, I certainly have had one, kind of a weak inner nurturance committee.
Mm-hmm.
And it's small. I mean, if you're going to take up arms against your oppressors, most of them live inside your own head, right? You know
right.
what I mean? You need allies. Like they say in AA, the mind's a dangerous neighborhood. Never go in alone.
I haven't heard that one, but I love it.
That's a good one.
But and also, if you're waiting for the environment to line up, for you to have courage, I mean, you could be waiting a while.
That's
so,
true.
I mean, I what I talk about, Chris, on this show on a regular basis is that it's important for people to step out. And, of course, then that requires faith, a belief that you are here for a purpose and that whatever brought you here supports your purpose. And to me, that's how it operates. But, you know, that's only my theory, of course. We have Joe on the line. Hi, Joe.
Hey, that's a beautiful saying. I liked what you just said.
All right. How are you?
Stepping out and having some faith.
Yes.
I'm doing good here in San Francisco. And
do you have a question or comment for Rick?
Sure do. I have a very strong spiritual grounding and had experiences with creating vastness of, even planets and stars. And having this knowledge and possessing, I've lived without doubt and find myself in a society that lives with a primal doubt about everything.
Mm-hmm.
And it's very difficult and hard to overcome sometimes. But like what you said, you know, we have the, what brought us here is also responsible for us and our, ability to come out and serve our purpose for being here. So,
I didn't exactly say that, Joe. I didn't exactly say that it's responsible for us serving our purpose. I think that, so I believe whatever brought us here is creative and it endowed us with the power to create also. So it's like a creativity, you know, chain of events that keeps going. And, you know, it sounds like you have had a lot of experience in that area. And do you have a question? Because, you know, we're getting down to the wire here and I just want to make sure that
yes,
we get your point.
If we were to have on our TV station good news on our news, wouldn't that cover a lot of spiritual happenings? I mean, we'd have to look in more than just like birthday parties and things. We'd have to look into who's doing what spiritually and having what experiences and having a look at that part of our society, because that goes under the rug and nobody knows nothing.
Okay. Let's let Rick respond to that, Joe. Thank you so much for calling.
All right. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Yeah. Well, thank you. Part of it, I think, has to do with how people use the word spiritual, which may be one of the most elastic words, you know, there is these days. And I think that if I imagine a news that is giving us the whole picture, which, you know, in other words, the whole mosaic, not just the 5 or 10 tiles out of 100 that are bad news that day, but the other 90 or 95 tiles in the mosaic that are, you know, include bad things that could have happened but did not.
Right, yeah.
You know, like Veronica was saying in the beginning, or, you know, the various good events in the world, ordinary simple accomplishments. Mm-hmm. I just got back from Japan, actually, and I think about the everyday kindness of people, you know, being helpful in subways or making good sushi, you know.
Mm-hmm,
just
right.
So much of the contribution that we make in the world is very modest, you know. We help kids across a crosswalk, or we just simply, you know, do a good job today bagging groceries.
Yeah.
And so, you know, and then addition to that, yeah, I would love to see more recognition of the vast mysteries that still surround our substantial scientific understandings.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's interesting and powerful to appreciate that until probably about 10 years ago, we as a species, scientists were completely ignorant of 95% of the universe, which is to say dark energy and dark matter.
Right.
Nobody knew about it. What other mysteries, you know, are out there? What other great oceans of mystery, you know, are lapping at our shores? And so I think, you know, there's it's appropriate to have an openness to those possibilities and also to appreciate the fact, I say this as a psychologist, that whatever people's faith tradition, and yes, of course, all kinds of terrible things have been done and are being done today in the name of various faith traditions. Mm-hmm. That said, for many people, studies show that one of the primary resources for them is their faith tradition, which means in particular the community of other people.
With that the fellowship, they can, absolutely.
Yeah, the fellowship, the, mm-hmm. the gathering, you know, good company, if you will.
Mm-hmm.
And I'd love to see more media that celebrates that. And I personally would love to see more media that includes people like Joe, who can talk, you know, from a wider perspective than the really, really narrowing of perspective that you see on, you know, mainstream media today.
Right. But, you know, some interesting things are occurring here with electronic devices. I noticed they're getting smaller and smaller. And, you know, and it's just a matter of time before they're implanted in us. You know, we will get back to spirituality one way or another. And I think I read something recently in the internet about experiments in which people were controlling things with their minds. And that's a reality now. And I just think it's wonderful. We are moving ahead despite ourselves. And I think, Joe, if you really spend a lot of time combing the newspapers, if you read one, I think you will find some positive stories there. Just even if it's nothing more than, for instance, what Rick just said about things that didn't occur that could have. So, again, we just in the final moments of this wonderful interview, the telephone number, and in case you have a quick comment or question, is 510-848-4425 or 1-800-958-9008. If you have some participation that you'd like to add to this conversation with Rick Hansen. So, Rick, do you give seminars? You mentioned that earlier, and meditation. You write, I know. And, yeah. And tell me about your practice. What do
oh,
you,
sure.
How do you do your, what goes on during your day, Rick?
Yeah, right. Well, that's kind of a handoff to say something I wanted to say.
Yeah.
I have
synchronicity.
Yeah. I have a lot of free resources at my website, and people can reach it just my name, rickhansson.net. Another way to get there is maybe easier to remember, buddhisbrain.com.
Oh,
anyway,
yeah. Okay.
The point is, at that website are really tons of resources freely offered. Many, mm-hmm. many talks I've given, many articles, slide sets from many workshops I've given, excerpts, things like that. It's all free.
Mm-hmm.
There are a few things that are, you know, they'll take you to Amazon. You know, my book's $12 on Amazon.
Yeah, okay.
So there you have it. But otherwise, on that website, there are a lot of resources, including links to other really cool things on the internet, including scientific websites and, you know, places where you can learn more about the brain in plain English, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So there's that part. So that kind of backs up a lot of what we talked about. And I also do a newsletter that's called Just One Thing, that this book is based on. The book is a lot more polished and it goes into a lot more depth than the weekly newsletter does, but the newsletter's free, and it's also it's almost 30,000 people subscribe to it now, and there's a real community of people who are interested in that. So those resources are very available to anybody.
Mm-hmm.
BuddhistBrain.com.
Okay, and what's the other one? RickHansen.net.
They're the same. They'll take you to the same website.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, it's been a pleasure.
I really
enjoyed it. I can't believe how time flies.
Thank you.
We're just getting into it. I was getting warmed up. I was going to take you on, Rick.
Go for it. Well, I'd like that.
Not really. But I love it. You know, your book is just, I really resonated with it when they sent me the PR information. And I wish everybody had one of these. So
yeah.
Go out and check out his website at BuddhistBrain.com and get the newsletter so you can start your own practice for the new year.
That's right.
All right. Thank you so much.
Oh, let's make the world a better place.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
It starts right here.
Yeah.
I'll be back after this musical break.